פתאום זה מרגיש כמו תיבת נוח פה. לאט לאט גשם יותר ויותר, ואנחנו פשוט יכולים כזה to float away, meditating quietly. Rest of the world. So the title of the talk is the toolbox, the Argaz Kelim, the toolbox of joy. We talked before about joy being equipment of the mind. So what are the tools? And maybe some of you are thinking, well, Stephen's not a Buddhist. Buddhists talk about suffering, not joy. When's the suffering going to come? Okay, we'll have a bit. Because actually, you can't really talk about joy without also bringing into the picture suffering or difficulty, because the two are so closely connected one to the other. But what are they? What is joy? What is pain? What is it? What's happening? I think it's clear, we all know that what pain is, a headache is pain. We don't have to ask too much about this headache. It's pain. And it's our experience of damage, of loss, of wound, threat. Patua, wound, yeah. That the body feels directly as pain. And the body responds with a voice to the mind, to the self. I'm under attack. Help me. That's the voice of pain. I need attention. The voice of pain. But that's the beginning. Because what happens then is that we do whatever we can to avoid this voice. This voice is a voice we don't want to hear. So we do everything we can to shut down this voice, saying wound, threat, harm, damage, death, loss, not being. So the being does everything to stop this voice of not being. Namely, the fear of pain, the worry about pain, the threat that there might be pain to the body. And then it starts on from there. The fear of threat, of problem, of loss, not to the body, but to the self that is trying to look after the body. So there's another level to this. So then the self spends its whole life busy trying to defend itself against problems that might happen to the self, forgetting that the problem is to the body, not to the self, but the self just gets busy with this. And so the self spends its whole life busy trying to defend itself with every kind of protection, shirion, armor, busyness, worry, endlessly from birth to death, trying to stop it, the possibility of this voice, which really is just a voice of the body, not of the self. and so much unnecessary chains of being concerned with pain. You know that old joke about the telegram from the Polish mother to their relative somewhere far away, says, "Start worrying, details to follow."
Polish mother.
Mostly it's all taken, all this busyness, this isuk with difficulty, pain, suffering is around the self that takes on the clothes of protection when actually it doesn't need to. But the self, that's how it identifies itself. I must be in control so as to prevent possible damage, hurt, loss, difficulty, or the voices of difficulty, pain, and so on. So the headache, the self says, I have to stop the headache, take a pill now. That's the act in response to pain. And we are doing that, taking that pill, that Akamol, in all the time, trying to navigate our life to prevent these voices. And the self builds very strong self about around that. In fact, the self is largely built from defense and control. That's its basic nature. The self is busy with and is kind of built from defense, haganatiyut, and control. And that's what it is. That's why it's there. In a way, the Buddha pointed out that what's called the Dharma of eight conditions. Eight conditions being those conditions that all life is trying to control or stop. All life wants pleasure and no pain, gain and no loss. Love or acceptance and no hate. Fame or confidence or pride and no smallness. And it's the same with an ant as a human being. A fly has eight conditions, as a human being has eight conditions. And because it's so universal, it's called the Dharma of Eight Conditions. It's a kind of Buddhist biology. We learnt it in biology, that all life has, you know, nutrition, excretion, This is a kind of Buddhist biology. All life has eight conditions. What it's busy with. How it identifies its survival. How it works for its survival. So this is what we're talking about. And that's our experience of pain. And joy is exactly the opposite voice. It's the voice that nothing is wrong. That why not be happy? The pain voice comes in and says, we've got lots of reasons not to be happy. What do you mean be happy? It's not evolutionary to be happy. You can't survive by being happy. You've got to be worried and anxious and concerned and predicting all the time what's the next threat. Happiness is not helpful. But the happy one, the happy voice comes along and says, look, I'm warm, I'm dry, and I have food in my belly. What's the problem? Warm, dry, and well fed. What's the problem? The other problem with joy is that it needs less self. The self actually resists joy because it's a threat. The self has invested so much in protection that when joy comes along and says, yeah, what's the problem? Warm, dry and well fed, what's the fuss? The self feels that as a threat. What? I'm spending all my time protection, and the voice of joy tells me I'm not needed. Where's my salary? I think we can feel this. I hinted at it in the talk yesterday, that I asked you all to remember a situation where we feel great joy and happiness. And every time I've done this with groups, they've always come up with experiences in the life that need less self. Like swimming under the water, or climbing on the hill, or watching the sunset, or looking at a beautiful structure or a beauty. As Krishnamurti says, beauty is there when the self is not. These experiences need less self, need less selfing, because the selfing is built on protection, armor, shirion, concern and control. And beauty is out of that picture, and swimming under the water is out of that picture, and the beautiful morning walk is out of that picture, and sex is out of that picture. And I think all of us would immediately recognize that in sex, which is perhaps the most pleasurable thing that can happen to sexual beings, not necessarily humans, there's less self. The whole act of sexual union is about letting go of the self and merging with the other. An impossible thing to happen. The self. That's me, but it's usually in the Dharma, the self is more of an active, is regarded as more of an active process called selfing. That's how you say in Hebrew. That's, you made it up just now?
No, it's Danny's concept.
Okay.
It's a nice one.
Good. So, selfing. Making of self, self construction. Ha bnia shel atzmi, she kol hazman banui et atzmo, o anachnu bonim et atzmeinu, kol hazman, kol hazman. Zihut, identity also. We were just talking, you'd be surprised what we get up to in the table at the end of the dining hall. You'd be surprised. Today we were talking about the orgasm of birth, orgasmic birth, the experience of birth, leida. The experience of birth is for some people an orgasmic, ecstatic, life-transforming experience for some women, which transforms utterly their whole life. That moment of birth, forget postnatal depression, postnatal ecstasy, and it happens. It's happened to many. The act of giving birth is ultimately not self. It's not me. It's the universe that gives birth through the mother. The universe is giving birth through the mother. The baby is dropping out of the universe into the world, and the mother is where's the self there? Okay, it's painful, it's difficult, all of that is true, but these ecstatic moments, the joy is beyond self. And therefore, very often, the self feels that joy is a threat, and that's why we have to use Argaz Kelim, a toolbox, to remember joy. It's in us, but it's shut down. And the voices of, not of pain, but of working to prevent pain of the self, are busy trying to push away joy, because it's a problem in a way. So I want to go a bit closer now to discuss in the Dharma, after practicing a little bit today, some ways in which joy is opened, the doorway to joy is opened. And the first way I want to discuss is something that was mentioned at the beginning of the retreat, and is something that is hidden inside this retreat, between the lines, Bein HaShurot. Not so visible unless you notice it. And that is some purity, tahor, of values and actions which is holding this retreat together. A primary one is generosity, nedivut. The practice of generosity is a primary practice that in the Eastern tradition comes before meditation. And not only in the Eastern tradition of Dharma. In yoga, the Patanjali eight steps of Patanjali, what comes first? Yam, niyam. Only after that, begin to practice with the body. The purification of our action is a first step to move out of the territory of suffering, threat, difficulty, control, and so on, and contraction. Hitkavtsut. It's the actually opposite of hitkavtsut, contraction. This contracted hand is me. I want. And this open hand is I'm not so important here. I give. Anyway, it's coming through me. I don't own anything. The money comes to me and I pass it on. The flow that I'm just part of is the open hand. Right? And this open hand of generosity or it starts the process of letting things flow beyond the protection, beyond the shirion, letting flow. It's what's happening here. The generosity of people that set this retreat up, the generosity of people that said, let's do a radical experiment that Tovana has been doing the last few years. Invite a retreat, spend lots and lots of money, and trust that we won't collapse. Generosity built in, inviting anybody that wants to come, to eat, to sleep, to learn Dharma, to practice together, and trust. Generosity is behind what we're doing here. The generosity of the staff, that you don't see so much, but they've been cooking all 2 days already, non-stop. The generosity of the teachers that just come and love to teach and share and listen, and all the energy that goes there. The generosity of each of you that are giving to the next person even though you don't notice you're giving. How are you giving? By your intention, Hitkav New York. By just your being. By your being serious about practice, helps the person next to you. We're giving, we're in a world of giving. And it helps us. And the Buddha said, giving creates inner peace and inner contentment. Contentment, shviat ratzon. From contentment, we begin to meditate. From a place of contentment, our meditation goes deeper. We concentrate more easily. We feel more at ease. We feel more connected, less contracted. So, one of the conditions for meditation is joy. And one of the conditions for joy is meditation. They help each other. Can you still hear me back there? Okay. I mean, actually you don't need to hear me. The rain is much more, has got a lot more to say than I have. The Dalai Lama once said, it's so much more joyful to give to others than to have for yourself, because there's more of them. Not only generosity, but also non-harming. As Yonatan said yesterday, this sense of non-harming just exactly works in the opposite direction from threat, contraction, pain, concern and fear. By non-harming, by protection of others, by kind eyes, by looking at the other with kind eyes, kindness, by caring, patiyut, all these things are happening here, right, in this retreat. I hope he's recording. The best Dharma talk. This could go on for quite a long time, so I'll keep talking. And if you don't hear me, can you please come up closer, okay? Because there's a lot of place here. I don't think I can shout more than this. So if you don't hear me, please come. Okay, if you don't hear me, please come, because that's about as far, as loud as I can comfortably go. So in the Dharma practice, the act of generosity, of care, of non-harming, lead to the opening of the heart and to joy. And then there is practice, what we would call meditation practice. We haven't talked a lot about what this is. There just hasn't been that much time in this retreat to give a full talk about mindfulness and concentration and so on. But I think you've picked up the basics. I'll just give a few points here. Mindfulness is, in the Pali term sati, it means giving attention to what's below the radar. Giving attention to what is happening in this body here. It's using the life, the body, the mind as the object of meditation. Being mindful, full of mind. Being aware, being awake to what's really happening and not what we think about it, our explanations about it, our concerns about it. What is really happening in the present moment, in this lived body and mind right now? That's the practice. And it's a primary practice in the Dharma. There are many, many, many kinds of meditation practice, but I would say in the Dharma, mindfulness is central, or one important, very important practice, not the only one, of course, and it's become very dominant as meditation originating from the Buddhist world in the West today. So it's taken a very important place in the modern world, the Western world. It's the translation of sati, mindfulness, is to remember to be aware, to be here, to be right here, without judgment, without layers of commentary, without choosing what to look at, the freedom to be right here with what's happening to me here and now. It has in it quite a lot of stillness and quietness. And that's why we sit 45 minutes, to really get into it. It doesn't need 45 minutes. We can be mindful, sitting on the grass, drinking a cup of tea. But the stillness adds a dimension of depth and quietness. So it's quietness, concentration with mindfulness together is what we're practicing here. There's a joke that I heard some time back about two women talking about their daughters, and they're saying, one woman says, "My daughter still hasn't found herself. She doesn't know what she's doing. She's giving me a lot of trouble." And the other woman says, "My daughter is more or less the same, but she's a bit better now. She's found something called Vipassana. I don't know what it is, but at least she's not sitting around doing nothing." So we're doing nothing, just sitting, watching the life process in us. That's basically mindfulness. And if we go deeper into the life process itself, we can begin to make an equation. I say, Ashva, Mishva, the life process in us is equal to joy. We begin, if we go consistently into it, we begin to see and feel the life process itself as joy. It is joy. The life experience itself, without worry, concern, protection, etc., etc. That is joy. That's what it is. That's our experience of life, is joy. But it goes a bit further than that, because one of the major sources of our joy indeed is vipassana, a process of insight. What it is we really learn, the transformation that happens to us when we practice mindfulness, the Dharma, right action, etc. The whole practice, especially the meditation, brings insight. Vipassana means to see clearly. That's why tovana, insight, seeing things clearly. And when we see clearly into, for example, the self, we see the games of the self, we see how unnecessary all this anxiety and worry is, we see how the self gets itself stuck into constantly being busy against threat and problem that don't yet exist. We see how the self dominates our life and controls our life, and we begin through this insight to begin to see the territory which is not self. Just what we talked about, below the radar. A breath isn't self, it's just a breath. When we begin to discover, not theoretically, but practically, by real seeing, the breath isn't owned by me. My breath. We may think it's my breath, it might feel like my breath, but if we look carefully, it isn't. Doesn't have a label on it saying, this breath belongs to Stephen only. Please, when you finish with it, put it back. It's more than that. Vipassana, or insight, helps us to peel off the kaleth, to peel all those blocks and patterns, tavniyot, and issues that obsess us in our life and steal our joy. For example, judgment, bikoritiyut, on ourself or on others. It's happening to all of us. It steals our joy. I'm sure that many of you here may be thinking, maybe having these thoughts right now. Oh, it's all very well talking about joy, but the coffee there isn't hot enough, and it's too, my room is cold, and he's talking too much, and the retreat should be better, and you know, but it's nice to hear about joy. they can't help, the patterns are there in us, and judgment is one of the classic ones. Vipassana, insight, helps us to open, to peel back, peel away these layers of blocks, of obsessions, of loops in the mind, margalim. But the Buddha called them stains on the cloth, katamim, on the cloth. And when we clean these stains on the cloth, we feel lighter, we feel freer, and like the clouds, the sun comes out by itself. When the clouds go, just the sun comes out, and it's so much easier for us to be joyful. I don't think that most of the Buddhist practice is about trying hard to be joyful. Not trying to be joyful. It's actually just removing the clouds. And when you remove the clouds, the sun shines by itself. We are less busy with our personal dramas, the soap opera, opera sabon of our life. We're just less busy with this opera sabon. And so life comes through, life flows, just by itself, and we feel joy by itself. We don't need to do so much. There's a slight problem. I don't know how long I can keep going. Maybe you all better come here. So anyway, I don't have much more to say, so I'll just keep going for a few more minutes. For those new to Vipassana and to the Dharma, one of its big powers is a complete reframing, new relationship to pain and difficulty that comes from this peeling away of being the self and its busyness with pain. We begin to see how we are busy with pain and suffering and let it go. And a completely new relationship with pain and suffering. And from there, the voice of pain, what Eckhart Tolle called the pain body, get smaller and smaller and smaller as we practice. The pain body, it just becomes less dominant in our life. And the joy body gets bigger and bigger. We become friends with pain instead of enemy. Then life itself doesn't seem like an enemy that we have to have protection against. We are with, just what we were practicing here, if we are with a painful experience, but not turning it into suffering. We're allowing things to be as they are, and not being busy with building the pain, the suffering, and the next one, and what might be, and all the concern. We have a new relationship to pain. We know it as habit, we know it as constructions. A final question or comment. Many of you might think that the whole world of ecstasy and ecstasy meaning inner ecstasy, rapture, what in English you call rapture or bliss, is an integral part of the meditation practice. We may have read it in books and so on and heard about it, and it's there. But generally, it's not something that we're all looking for in meditation practice. It's something that it's very nice in deeper practice. It happens. It can happen by itself in deeper practice, especially with deep concentration, with a really deep focus, what you call one-pointedness, focus on one object deeper and deeper and going inside, then experience of ecstatic joy can come from the practice. But that actually, that's not the issue, and that's not a goal of meditation. The goal of meditation, goal of our practice, is transformation. And the ecstasy itself comes and it goes. And even the joy, we're talking about a joy which is deeper. The joy that we really value is more contentment, shleimut, shalva amuka, something that stays with us, that is with us under any circumstances, that cannot be taken away from us by disease, by loss, by pain. It's something that underneath. I remember in Varanasi in 1975, I spent a year in Varanasi, and I had a flat by the Ganges, and it was just on the Ganges. So every morning I'd open my door and run out of my flat and dive into the Ganga and swim. I'm still here. For about 1 year also, every morning swimming in the Ganges. But there was a line of beggars on the sand, and there was one beggar who had no arms and no legs, and he was in a box that was pushed by someone else. And I remember this till today. I remember this man. Firstly, the fire in his eyes. I've never forgotten the fire in his eyes, and it was a fire of joy. And he used to sing with his whole heart. He was singing with his whole being out loud, with the fire in his eyes, and like this. And it was no artificial thing to get money. He didn't even notice whether anyone gave him money or didn't give money. It was so amazing to watch this man singing at the top of his voice every day, 8 months, 9 months, and being pushed around with no arms, no legs, pushed in a box. For me, it's the image of joy that has no conditions, that is beyond all conditions. Thank you.
So that's just a couple of minutes of quietness.